So Melinda and I are really excited. Today we're joined by Robert Miller. He's the creator and publisher of the Black Chronicle and La Cronica, publications that use the newspaper format to tell African-American and Mexican-American history. He's also the creator of the website Our History as News. And we're lucky because Miller is a Greene County resident. He was also formerly the director of educational publishing at WNET, New York City's public television station, Channel 13. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you can join us. And I wish, this is one of those moments when I wish radio had some kind of visual visual or material component because we have a couple of copies here of the Black Chronicle and La Cronica. So I'm wondering, for someone who's listening, if you could just introduce them and us to these publications.
Sure. Well, they can see the publications on ourhistoryasnews.org. That's the website that I created several years ago when I came back to these projects after being at WNET, which is the New York City public television station, for longer than I like to remember. I was I was director of educational publishing, and when I left 13, I came back to these projects, which I've always thought of as my life's work, and partly because I guess they introduced me to the power of engaging educational approaches. Way back in the late 60s, I was an actor in a play called Riot. It was created by a theater workshop in Boston called the Ohm Theater Workshop, and it was about the riots, which were prevalent in those late years of the 60s. But at the same time, I was writing for an education magazine, mostly about the failures of American education.
Mm.
The play began as a panel discussion between two African Americans and two whites. The purpose of the panel discussion was to kind of look at the future of race relations. And the discussion finally broke up into a fist fight, and then we had a riot under strobe lights in the theater, which was off Broadway in New York. The play won an Obie, but it closed because there was a newspaper strike the day that it opened, and so no one knew about it.
And what year was this?
1969, I believe. Well, when the play closed, I had been, as I said, writing about education and the failures, especially in American history. And something one of my interviewees had said gave me this idea. And the idea was that to present African American history using an engaging format, the tabloid newspaper, I was kind of at a turning point. I could have continued in the theater, or I could have pursued this project. And it was the late 60s, and we felt that we felt that things were changing, not just changing, but being transformed. And as a member of what we thought of as the generation of change, I decided that I would do this project. So for a year, I lived on a houseboat on the 79th Street Pier in New York City, and had no money. Every day I would travel back and forth to the Schomburg collection, which is one of the great collections of African American history, on 135th Street, to create a prototype issue of this newspaper that I had in my head. My idea was that for each of what turned out to be 14 issues of the Black Chronicle, I would select an event that was a key event in the history of African Americans. So for my prototype, I chose the Dred Scott decision. And the reason I chose it was because it was just before the Civil War. And in the late 60s, we really felt that we were on the verge of a civil war of sorts, certainly a culture war, and more than that. And the Dred Scott decision was a pivotal event in the kind of years leading up to the Civil War, because Dred Scott had been taken to a free state, or a state that had been declared free under the Missouri Compromise. And so he claimed his freedom. But the Supreme Court, under Justice Taney, said that the Missouri Compromise nullified the Missouri Compromise, and said there were no free states. African Americans had no rights under the Constitution, And there was no place for a person escaping slavery to hide. Well, this was a stunning, a horrifying event in history, and it led towards the Civil War. In any event, that's the event that I chose as my lead story, and I built the newspaper around it. And my idea was, and the way I did it was, I used the best historians, Benjamin Quarles, John Hope Franklin, C. Van Woodward, all of the great historians to kind of inform the material that I wrote. But I would use the writing styles of the contemporary newspapers to give it flavor. And so in some cases, I would actually take small advertisements or tiny little articles. And so the lead story in what turned out to be issue 4 was Scott Still a Slave. Dred Scott, this is the opening paragraph. Dred Scott is still a slave. In a decision that crushed Scott's hope for freedom, the Supreme Court today threw out his case and ruled that no Negro, enslaved or free, is a citizen of the United States. Speaking for the court's majority, Chief Justice Taney declared, "The people of the Negro race are not included and were not intended to be included under the word citizens in the Constitution and can therefore claim none of the rights and privileges which that instrument provides and secures to citizens of the United States." Powerful stuff. Without going too deeply into this particular issue, because there's so much, I was interested in Dred Scott because I had always thought when I was in school that he was a test case, maybe put forward by the abolitionists. But I wanted to know what he wanted. Did he try to win his slavery? What was his interest in this? And in my research at the Schomburg, I found an article in the Black Scholar, which was a magazine, and this is what it says. Dred Scott is 61 years old. He is married and has two daughters. Scott's first wife was sold away from him. He once escaped from his master and lived for a time in a nearby swamp. Before suing for his freedom, he attempted to buy his family from his mistress, but she refused him. And so there you go. There's the answer. This was a flesh and blood human being with passions and desires and frustrations. So
that the format of that magazine, so you're taking text that you've found text, and then also you've been rewriting it in what you sort of have perceived to be the language of other people?
Most of the articles, the news stories, the editorials, the features, were written by me, although later on I had a staff, were written by me using the best history that I was able to come up with. The short pieces, in some cases, I lifted from the old newspapers. There's an ad here for leeches for medical purposes that were taken from a newspaper, but it would have been interesting to simply reprint articles from the period, but it wouldn't have been instructive because in the hindsight, and that's what historians do.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a way of delivering history, I built up this issue around it, and then I went out to try to get a publisher.
So the rest of that issue is built around the time of the Dred Scott decision.
Exactly. So some of the articles in this pre-Civil War issue are anti-slavery activity increasing among free blacks. I mean, you can see that that's a feature that would have been written by pulling together many sources.
Mm-hmm.
A Central Park for Manhattan. This was about Frederick Law Olmsted designing Central Park. Mm-hmm. I wanted to use materials that weren't necessarily about African Americans to create that moment in history, that multifaceted moment, so that my idea was that this would be used in schools primarily, although now it's being used in churches and by families and many different places. And so with this completed article, I went out looking for a publisher, and I was sadly disappointed for the first year. I didn't have a track record. I was white. And I should say about that, when I got the idea, as I said, I felt that I was part of a generation of change, and because the world was changing. And so I decided that I would pursue this project not just for the African-American community, but for the white community, because I felt, as I've named my website, Our History as News. This is mm-hmm. our history. This is the history of America. So in any event, I was frustrated in finding a publisher, and then I met Henry Hampton, who was the president of Blackside. Blackside was a company in Boston, famous now for Eyes on the Prize, mm-hmm. which Henry produced later on. But I met him when Blackside was just beginning. And his idea was that he would help anyone with a good idea for promoting social justice. It didn't matter what their race was. And so he gave me a home to develop this project. And together we found a publisher, Holt Reinhart and Winston. And they published The Black Chronicle, which was composed of 14 issues of the newspaper, which began at the American Revolution and went up through the Montgomery bus boycott and Rosa Parks. 14 teacher's guides, 14 cuts on two LP records, and 14 overhead transparencies. It was a huge project, and we did it in 1 year. I had a small staff of researchers and writers, and we produced it. So anyway, that's how it happened. And then once Holt started distributing it to schools, I left and went off to my next project, which was called La Cronica, that I'll tell you about later. But I thought maybe if you wanted, I could read a couple of articles from.
I think that would be great. It was so interesting to hear you talk about the Dred Scott decision and to dive into some of that content. And I am really interested in hearing you also just talk, before we dive into another, about the choice to use the newspaper format and about these papers as a real pedagogical tool. I read on your website, Our History as News, there was a line that said the Black Chronicle was originated as a way of bringing immediacy to history. And so can you talk about why you think the newspaper format can tell these stories well?
Sure. Newspapers are designed to get attention. I mean, there are sensationalist newspapers, there are staid, respectable newspapers, but no matter what their kind of point of view and sensibility, they use headlines and to grab your attention. Now, I wanted to do the same thing, except I wanted to use it to teach history. And the fact that these are separate issues, each one is 4 pages long, I imagine that kids would put them in their pockets and take them home, ride on the bus and open them up and read them, read about Dred Scott, read about W.E.B. Du Bois, read about the black soldiers returning from World War I, just like they were reading the Daily News or the local newspaper. So, I felt, and I took a chance. It ended up being almost 5 years of my life developing this project because I felt that this format would have the advantage of the kind of the tabloid headline attention grabbing qualities of newspapers on the one hand, but that I was careful enough and I worked with historians to create materials that are historically legitimate. So that was the reason. I hope that answers your question.
It does,
Sarah.
And it is really it's amazing to imagine that someone of any age opening that paper and really imagining opening that paper and really being able to read that as news, imagining being alive in the day when that really could be the language that you were reading in the newspaper,
right,
or the events that you would be reading in the newspaper, and to meditate a little bit on what has changed and what hasn't.
Well, let me just read you one other very small piece in this issue of issue 4 that I think demonstrates how powerful this can be. The title is Appeal to the Benevolent. Woman desperately needs $500 to buy her son and two sons-in-law. That's all. And that came from a contemporary newspaper of the period. I mean, look how much that says.
And that's in the same issue as
exactly.
The Dred Scott decision.
Right, right.
And there's also a lot of stuff, or I mean, I was reading through, and there's things about wanting to start education opportunities. Like there was it was a gentleman trying to start education for young school boys and school girls wanting to learn how to read and write, and sort of giving sort of an elementary education and having the opportunity to do so. Like, I remember reading that and thinking that's so fascinating.
There are a lot of important themes that run throughout the newspapers. The development of the Black church, education, the Freedmen's Bureaus after the Civil War, in which a lot of dedicated people came from places like Boston and Massachusetts to come down and teach the freed slaves reading and writing and arithmetic. Another of the themes that I'm kind of enamored of are the great orators and the great African-American leaders. Frederick Douglass is one of my heroes. And in this newspaper, again, he commented on the Dred Scott decision, and this is what he said. "The Supreme Court is not the only power in this world. We, the abolitionists and colored people, should meet this decision, unlooked for and monstrous as it appears, in a cheerful spirit. This very attempt to blot out forever the hopes of an enslaved people may be one necessary link in the chain of events preparatory to the complete overthrow of the whole slave system." I mean, it was like he was a prophet.
Wow.
He was exactly right. And then there were men later on like W.E.B. Du Bois. I was fascinated earlier to hear about the Martin family, an African-American family in Ames, Iowa, and one of their... one of the young men in that family fought in World War I. And I believe the woman who was talking about it said he received the Croix de Guerre from the French for bravery, but that he and the other black troops were mistreated by the Americans, by the white American soldiers. And in the issue, the issue that's, I think it's issue 10 in this series, The Red Summer. The date of the issue is 1919. 400,000 African-American soldiers served in World War I. 400,000. And when they came back, there were riots across the country in white communities because they felt that these men had thought too much of themselves. And these were murderous lynching riots. Well, W.E. Du Bois was... the editor of Crisis, the NAACP magazine. And this is what he wrote in an editorial. "We return. We return from fighting. We return fighting. Make way for democracy. We saved it in France, and by the great Jehovah, we will save it in the United States of America, or know the reason why." That's stunning.
Wow.
Stunning stuff. So these are the kinds of powerful bits of information and lengthy features that my idea was to teach young people and older people as well about the richness of American history.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are just a couple of examples.
And one thing that I think is really interesting with newspapers, considering that they're sort of trying to track the immediate, like the current reality, is just the way in which language shifts, and how you've been chronicling a substantial amount of time, one in which has like a very distinct progression, and that language follows suit. And
right.
So was that sort of an interesting...
Good point. Very good point. It was interesting. It was fascinating. It was seductive, even. The newspapers in the 18th century, they barely had headlines. They were just columns with capital letters at the top. The language was very formal. And as Melinda, as you point out, as the issues moved along and became closer to the current time, the language changed, and I took a certain amount of license. I tried to have our language reflect the turns and the phraseology, but I wanted to keep our audience in mind, which were young people. And so I made sure that I used the the kind of contemporary language to flavor it, but not it. I try to keep it engaging, mm-hmm. but that was just another element of the old newspapers. I did my research at the Schomburg Collection, at the Widener Library in Harvard, at Harvard, the Boston Public Library, because once I moved up to Boston to be with Blackside, I did my research there, and also the New York Public Library, as well as a lot of private collections. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I remember walking out of the Widener Library with an 18th century book. You could just take books out of the library then. Nowadays, obviously, that's not possible. But it was a wonderful time. It was very exciting.
It's interesting to think about how these publications could serve also as kind of a gateway to more primary sources for people who are interested in them. So that the kind of research that allows historians to really dive into the archives or really dive into a place like the Schomburg, if someone is really riveted by looking through these papers, they start to get the taste and the flavor of what it's like to look into real primary sources.
Which is the purpose of a newspaper anyways, is to give you like a little tidbit of history, and then you can go and sort of find more content, or to compare newspapers.
Now, there are two current versions of Black Chronicle. One is the kind of collected set of 14 separate issues for use in schools. And then now there's a bound version. And the bound version has the bibliography bound into it. The other version, with the separate issues, there's a teacher's guide that has a bibliography so that people will know where these materials came from.
And tell us about La Chronica, which you mentioned, but we haven't actually heard about yet.
Yes. Well, after the Black Chronicle, I left it in the what I thought was the capable hands of the publisher, and I was full of this idea of enriching American history, and so I decided that my next project would look at Mexican American history, another story that's been maligned and overlooked. I went out to California and did a research trip throughout the Southwest, visiting collections and private historical societies and major libraries in Mexico, as well as California, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and Arizona, to determine if there was material that I could use to develop this project. And I came back and decided that there was. And I got a foundation grant to begin it, and collected a group of writers and researchers. And together we developed this project called La Chronica. Now, La Chronica, the first issue, is dated in 1835. And at that time, California, New Mexico, Arizona were all, and Colorado, were all still part of northern Mexico. And so, although the Black Chronicle begins in 1776, a kind of violent wartime issue, then the lead story is that Rhode Island offered slaves their freedom to fight for the colonial armies. That was Black Chronicle. But La Chronica begins in a very kind of serene time, when the California missions, the lead article is that the California missions are going to be secularized.
Mm.
And there are stories about the Apache raids in New Mexico and Arizona and the problems for Mexico and Texas. But it's a very staid issue. The second issue, 1848, is right after the war, in which the United States basically captured one-third of Mexico, California, Arizona, mm-hmm. and New Mexico, and paid $15 million. In the view of many historians, this was a kind of a violent expansion of manifest destiny by President Polk. And the articles that we have in the subsequent issues are about how, even though the former Mexican citizens, who now were U.S. citizens, actually they were given the option to either maintain their Mexican citizenship or take United States citizenship. How even though they had been promised that their land ownership would be respected, it wasn't. In California, for example, there was a law that was passed that required landowners to prove in court that they owned their land using their deeds and so on. And you can imagine, because they weren't familiar with American justice, they had to hire Anglo lawyers who took their payment in land. And so the land was lost, you know, it was just a
lost kind of in translation.
Exactly. So in any event, La Crónica is bilingual, Spanish and English. There are 9 issues. The first is 1835, and then after the war, the American-Mexican War, the date is 1848, then 1859, I believe, when Juan Cortina, who was a Mexican landowner, revolted against the land grabs. And it goes up through the growth of the Chicano movement in California and Colorado. And in 1969, I think it was, there were high school walkouts led by Chicanos who were part of this new movement of self-awareness on the part of Mexican Americans. And I met a lot of wonderful people and had a lot of help on this. And La Crónica's also has a teacher's guide, and it's used in schools now. And as I say, it's another reason, Sarah, going back to your question about why I chose this format, aside from the engaging quality of newspapers, there are lots of different reading levels in newspapers. You know, if you're in a class of students who have varied reading abilities, young people can read that little piece on Dred Scott. They can read the poster for Wanted, for Runaway Slaves, and people with better reading skills can read the features and the editorials. And so it's another advantage of the newspaper format.
I also think there's an amazing parallel between the question of selectivity in the news, what makes the news, to what makes it into our history textbooks and what makes it into our historical narratives. And so it's why I love that, I mean, your website, ourhistoryisnews.org, which really just makes it very explicit. These histories are also part of our story.
History is written by the victors, is what someone said. But in this case, the Black Chronicle and La Crónica do tell stories of triumph. For example, in the 14th, the last issue of Black Chronicle, or the next to the last, 1848, there's an article about how A. Philip Randolph pressured President Truman into desegregating the armed forces. And Randolph had done the same thing with FDR, pressuring him by threatening a march on Washington, forcing him to desegregate the war industries. And so these are triumphs that we, for the most part, don't really know about. We weren't taught about them. Admittedly, over the years, American history has been enriched. But that was why I did this project. So that's my story.
So what is also kind of interesting to me is like when you were, so this was when you were researching and putting together the Black Chronicle and going to various archives and libraries and sort of assembling by actually looking at history through paper form or through some sort of historical article or document.
Well, everything. Yeah.
And now you can sort of source everything from the internet. And so that whole process of coming in tangible sort of proximity to articles are now like how, so could you talk about sort of transitioning into internet form or sort of more digital form?
Well, I loved having these 18th century books and newspapers in my hand. I loved it. I loved the way they smelled. I loved the way they looked. I was lucky. Also, because that was a freer time when you really could hold on to the real stuff. But the explosion of materials on the web now gives young people or anyone the opportunity to do exactly what I did, and they don't have to leave their desks. the historical research has been opened up just fantastically now. So the kind of thing that I've done could be done much more easily by people instead of having to live on a houseboat and taking the, whatever it was, the IRT every day up 235th Street and back with no money. But the internet has given, you know, young people and historians the opportunity not just to do this kind of thing, but to do news broadcasts, to podcasts, you know, video materials. It's just unlimited. It's frightening, actually, and exciting. Mm.
But there's nothing like holding a paper in your hand and unfolding it and opening it, which is why I think it's so brilliant that these are also really in print form. So people can buy these in their sets.
Exactly. If they go to my website, ourhistoryisnews.org, they can buy La Cronica and Black Chronicle. And if they're interested in the teacher's guide, then they should contact me. There's contact information on the website, but my address is rmiller@ourhistoryasnews.org, but it's on the website.
And I wonder if we can round out this conversation with another reading. I hadn't realized that you were also an actor. And it is President's Day. I wonder if we could hear another excerpt or another article from one of these.
Thanks for asking. There's been some controversy recently over a book called Master of the Mountain by Henry Wycheck. He's a historian who wrote about Thomas Jefferson. And his book points out, with support, I think, that Jefferson was not a benign slave owner, as we have liked to consider him. Yeah. But he maintained slavery even after playing such a kind of vital and tremendous role in the writing of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. He maintained slavery because, according to Wycheck, because it was economically advantageous. Not only that, but his reputation as a benign, kind slave owner is, I think, shattered by Wycheck's book, where it talks about how he permitted some violent punishments of his slaves. So it turns out that I have in the second issue, 1794, after the writing, which comes out after the writing of the Constitution, I have a little feature about Jefferson and Benjamin Banneker, who was an African-American scientist here in the United States. The first piece is titled, Jefferson Calls Negroes Inferior. Quote, comparing them, Negroes, by their faculties of memory, reason, and imagination, it appears to me that in memory they are equal to the whites, in reason much inferior, and I think one could be scarcely found to be capable of tracing and comprehending the investigations of Euclid, and that in imagination they are dull and tasteless. Religion, indeed, has produced a Phyllis Wheatley, the great poet, but it could not produce a poet. The compositions published under her name are below the dignity of criticism. I advance it, therefore, as a suspicion only, that the blacks, whether originally a distinct race or made distinct by time and circumstances, are inferior to the whites in the endowments both of body and mind. That was Thomas Jefferson.
Wow.
Now, Banneker replies, now, sir, I apprehend you will embrace every opportunity to eradicate that train of absurd and false ideas and opinions which so generally prevails with respect to us, and that your sentiments are concurrent with mine, which are that one universal Father hath given being to us all, and that he hath not only made us all of one flesh, but that he hath also, without partiality, afforded us all the same sensations and endowed us with all the same faculties, and that however variable we may be in society or religion, however diversified in situation or color, we are all of the same family and stand in the same relation to him.
Wow. What year was that?
1794. I'm not sure when... It was around that time when Jefferson.
But that's the date for that publication.
That's the date for this publication. You raise a point that was a challenge because the editions of each newspaper had to have a specific date. I chose an event and dated the newspaper at that event, but there were incidents that happened prior to that, right, and incidents that were going to happen. And so for those, I for example, in the first issue of La Cronica, when all of the Southwest was part of Mexico, I had a small article that said, U.S. wants to buy San Francisco. And so that kind of looks a little forward. Well, that was a challenge of kind of the creative process in developing these materials.
But that is true. You have the luxury of having the future to sort of...
It's one of the nice things about being a historian. You know what the future was.
For people who are just tuning in or who have just heard a part of this conversation, we will have this conversation archived online if you want to listen back. And Robert Miller, we're hoping to have him back at the station at some point, because it's interesting to think about how this work might translate into a radio context.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Robert Miller is the creator and publisher of The Black Chronicle and La Cronica. I really do suggest you go online to ourhistoryasnews.org. Did I say that right? You can look through both The Black Chronicle and La Cronica, and also read about the history of the publication, and also you have some online resources that this links to, too.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. We're going to go out right now with both your and Melinda's favorite song. This is John Coltrane with My Favorite Thing. So thank you again, Robert, for joining us, and we'll see you again soon.
My pleasure.